Albert Einstein once said, "Today's problems cannot be solved if we still think the way we thought when we created them." Welcome to the 118th episode of Our Hen House, a place to find our way to change the world for animals. In today's episode, Marianne and I make a very big announcement about where we'll be spending 6 months of this year and why. Whoa. I'll give you a clue. It has to do with animal law, and for a while anyway, we will no longer be on the East Coast.
No.
We'll also give you the rundown on Marianne's birthday festivities, including vegan soft serve, Ghost the musical,
boo,
and the middle of the night visit we took to the Apple Store. We'll also report back on our vegan Passover, as well as our Easter, and we'll tell you about some exciting upcoming speaking engagements.
No!
Joining us today is Timothy Patcherat, the brilliant author behind Every 12 Seconds, Industrialized Slaughter and the Politics of Sight. Timothy, who is joining us in person here in our hen house, will tell us about what it was like working inside a slaughterhouse where 2,500 cows were killed per day, one every 12 seconds. He'll discuss his thoughts on animal agriculture being used as a metaphor for other forms of violence. He'll talk about ritual slaughter, and he'll discuss the question of who is more responsible, those who work in the slaughterhouse or those who eat the meat.
Workers!
Meat eaters!
You won't want to miss this eye-opening, riveting interview. And you also won't want to miss the opportunity to get your very own signed copy of Timothy Patcherat's Every 12 Seconds, which we'll tell you all about. For our review, we'll tell you about our favorite frozen fruits and vegetables and our best go-to ways to use them. All that, vegan banter, and of course, current events from the world of animal rights. My name is Jasmine Singer, and I'll be your co-host today in our hen house, along with my hitchhiker wannabe, Marianne Sullivan. Now please, pull up some hay. Let's get squawking. I'd like to welcome my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
Hello, my little driver. Driver, like, am I driving you crazy? Is that how we're starting today's episode?
Yes, there is that. But I think that I have at the front of all of my anxiety the fact that I'm going to be in a car, that you're going to be driving a lot.
It's true.
Like, of all the things I'm concerned about right now.
That's a big one, actually.
People out in our hen house land probably don't know that you're not the best driver.
That's not true.
Well, not the most experienced driver.
Okay, that's true. I moved into a city when I was 17.
You grew up in New Jersey!
I moved to Philadelphia when I was 17 and then New York when I was 19. There wasn't a lot of time to drive. But let's discuss why we're talking about driving in the first place, because we're New Yorkers. Why do we even need to drive? And it's because we have a very big announcement in store. We're going on the road. And we're going on the road.
Road trip!
Because you're going to be a visiting professor at Lewis and Clark Law School as part of the Center for Animal Law Studies for the fall 2012 semester, where you will be teaching two different animal law classes, and we're going to be in Portland, Oregon from July through December. Wow!
I know, I'm scared.
Yeah. No, I know. You should be. You should be petrified.
I think they have illusions about me.
Oh, but they're all true. They're so excited. We're so excited. This is such an amazing, amazing turn of events. You're so fantastic. You're already teaching at 94 schools in New York City. Why not add Portland to the mix? But that means we're going to be West Coasters for 6 months.
Yeah, it's crazy. Portland.
Portland.
I mean, it's like a dream come true. I mean, I don't actually want to move to Portland because I live where I live, but it is one of those cities that I just love.
Yeah, well, and that's good because we're going to be there.
Lewis and Clark is the most amazing place. It's one of the most beautiful campuses I've ever seen. And there's so many amazing people there. I'm just so impressed with myself.
They're at the vanguard of animal law. They've really been paving the way for animal law to wind up
as fabulous and recognized as it is now. It's offered in something like over 100 law schools throughout the country.
Yeah, it is. And that, well over 100. And that is an amazing development. And it has a lot to do with the work of the people at Lewis and Clark and the Center for Animal Law Studies, which is has an affiliation with Animal Legal Defense Fund. And they've been working on this stuff for years. But the situation at Lewis and Clark is just, I mean, it's amazing to anybody who's interested in the subject, because they don't have an animal law course. They have an animal law program. They have loads of different courses in animal law, from wildlife to farm animals, which I'll be talking about. And I'll be teaching. Do you think I'll be able to talk by the time I get to Portland? I hope so. And companion animal law issues, just every issue under the sun. Instead of combining them into one survey course, they each have their own course at Lewis and Clark. And on top of that, they have an LLM program. And if you're not familiar with what an LLM is, it's the advanced degree in law. And it's the kind of thing that people can go back. If they went to law school when there wasn't any such thing as animal law, and there were certainly no courses in animal law, and they really want to get up to speed, they can go to Portland and actually not just take a few courses, but get a full advanced degree.
Amazing. Yeah, that's just really incredible. It's just really amazing that we're going to be collaborating with the Center for Animal Law Studies in this way. I could see a lot more room for collaborations with them, especially as we grow to become an online magazine, which is also doing well. And we're going to be leaving on July 1st and driving out for 2 weeks with Rose. She has always wanted to go to the City of Roses. She expects there to be monuments.
She does throw up in the car, though.
Yeah,
that's
well,
that, I hope she gets over
no,
that.
No, she will. She gets over it within like a day or two. The first day or two will be bad. But you know what? I'll be throwing up, too. So.
Oh, good.
Sounds It'll be
like
lovely.
Fun.
You could drive. We'll vomit.
I cannot drive the whole way. And once we get to Portland, you have to do drive. You have to drive.
I'm going to. I'm also going to get a bike.
You know, Portland brags about its public transportation, and it does have good public transportation for an American city. But when you come from New York, the public transportation is just, you know, you can't rely on it 100% like you can here. It's just not a dense enough city. Mm-hmm. And we will be living a little, I think they call it out.
Out.
Yeah, not that close to downtown, because we'll be living close to Lewis and Clark. Yeah, I know. It's just
we're gonna
like
be in Selwood.
6 miles or something, but everything's pretty close. But I mean, you can't just totally rely on public transportation. You're going to have to drive the car.
I'm going to get a bike, too. I'm going to be in Portland. I have to have a bike and more tattoos.
True. It is bike land.
We don't actually have a car.
Yeah, that's another problem. We're going to steal cars, borrow people's cars. You're just going to like see one on the street, and I'm going to say, go drive the car.
No, that can't happen. But
we're going to get a car.
So we're going to talk about this throughout the next
short-term
couple
lease.
Months as this is approaching.
I just don't want to have a car left over when we move back to New York, because there's no greater nightmare than owning a car in New York.
What are the two classes you're going to be teaching?
I'm going to be teaching animal law fundamentals.
That's the class you teach
here?
Yeah,
it's basically the course I teach at several law schools in New York, only I teach it as a 2-credit course, and at Lewis and Clark, of course, being head of everybody, they offer it as a 3-credit course, so I'll be able to cover a lot more material,
and
which is exciting. Mm-hmm. And they've done some wonderful work with the course there. I'm just starting to find out all of the cool things that they do, which, of course, I'm going to steal when I teach it, and they do some field trips and some debates in class that just sound really creative. I'm very excited about that.
We're going to report on this back on our podcast throughout the time that we'll be in Portland, so we'll take lots of field trips and talk to lots of activists out there. And, by the way, we have a few trips planned for back to the East Coast, because we have speaking commitments that we already have in the calendar. So for those of you back in New York, don't cry for me, New York City, because we'll be back. I'll be back in August for the Blog Her National Conference.
We're going to drive out there and you're going to get on
fly back. And then we'll be back in November for the Wesleyan Conference that is honoring the work of Marty Keel. And that's really exciting, too, and a couple other trips as well. So.
And not to get back to me, but to get back to me, you didn't let me finish, because the second course I'm going to be teaching, in addition to Animal Law Fundamentals, is so exciting, and it's called Animals in Agriculture, and it's going to be all
that's
about
amazing.
Farm animals. And I'm so, I mean, just to
that's
be able to spend
is.
A full semester in a seminar discussing all of the legal issues surrounding farm animals and the policy issues. It's just, I can't wait for that.
I can't wait either.
And they have such great students out there. We've gone to the conference out there, they're so excited and involved and active. It's really a great atmosphere.
And it's going to coincide with our Hen House's new online magazine, hopefully really starting off. We thank you so much for those of you who have helped donate to that. We did this fund drive as part of your birthday, but it's going on through the end of the month, and we hope that you will help us to get to this new online magazine, because we have such amazing things in store for the magazine.
Yes, people have been so generous. I'm so grateful. I'm always embarrassed to ask for money, but you know, it's really going to be, I really feel like we're going to spend that money really, really well. And the thing that we're going to be producing, this new online magazine, is just going to take everything to a new level. And we have so many different people participating now and providing content, and there's just so much going on. You can feel it. Things are just taking off, and I want to be part of that, and I think our Hen House is really going to be part of that. Yeah, we will be continuing to fundraise for that until the end of the month, and you know, every penny we get for it, we'll be able to spend wisely, because you know, it's a now or never moment, and we will have to do the contract and buy the new website at the end of the month, and the more we can spend, the better it's going to be, and I can't wait. I mean, all of this stuff happening at the same time, it's almost overwhelming.
It's a little overwhelming, but we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and if you're interested in helping us support this new online magazine, we're trying to raise the last $5,000, and we are over $3,000 there, so we are getting there for sure, and you can help us out by going to crowdrise.com/OHH magazine. It's crowdrise.com/OHH magazine. So, how was your birthday, speaking of fundraisers?
My birthday was great.
It was a good day.
Yeah,
it was a crazy weekend.
I had a wonderful, wonderful birthday this year. Older to you, I have to say. You did a good. You're such a birthday pro.
Well, I think birthdays should be a national holiday. In fact,
it is true that everyone on the planet, everyone got born one
That's
day.
That's true.
It's not that unique.
No, not unique at all.
Everybody has a birthday.
That's something that we all
have
in common.
There's only 365 of them, and if you divide them up among everyone on the planet.
All right.
Animals as well. It's like, you know.
So what was your favorite part of your birthday?
Well, I have to say my favorite part came at the end.
Oh, what was that?
Well, it was after we had gone to the theater, which we'll talk about in a moment, and after we had gone out to dinner at Kyoto Fu and gotten their unbelievable vegan soft serve sundae.
Unbelievable. It's in Midtown.
Oh, my God. It's the best vegan ice cream.
Not enough people know about this place.
Because it's not a vegan restaurant, but they have lots of vegan food.
And they have vegan soft serve.
It's Kyoto very Fu. Traditional Japanese.
Kyotofu. Kyoto Fu, it's amazing.
The best ice cream in the world. Then, on an impulse, it was even, my birthday was just about over. On an impulse, we decided to go and buy my last present, which we hadn't yet gotten, which was my new iPhone. And we went to the 24-hour Mac store.
Right.
We walked over to Fifth Avenue to the 24-hour Mac store, which, even though it's like, not in a crowded part of the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a crowded part during the day, but not at night. Fifth Avenue, 59th Street, near the park. It was packed.
Packed at like 12:30 a.m. And we got you your iPhone. But on the way there, we called Darling Ari.
Oh, that's right.
And we told him that we had just seen Ghost of the Musical and that then we had vegan soft serve. And now we were walking to get your new iPhone at the 24-hour Mac store. And he replied, God, I love New York.
Yeah, it was a good New York moment. New York has its stresses and strains. There's no doubt about it. But every once in a while, it really comes through. And that was definitely one of those
moments. It was a good day. What did you think of Ghost?
I liked it. I really enjoyed it. It was fun, but I didn't love it.
Well, it was done in a very,
also,
like, kind
you know,
of...
We all know the story. I mean, who hasn't seen that movie?
It was done in a kind of spectacular way. There were lots of lighting effects. There was
big production.
Movies going on behind you. There was a lot of special effects. I do have to say, one thing that I didn't like was our fellow audience members. It's like they had...
That was crazy.
It's like they had missed the memo on how to be a polite audience member. There were people behind us talking at full volume. Stan, she's making something out of pottery. She actually said that. And then there were these other other people around us, like
with the crinkling bag.
Like a candy bag the entire time, first and second act.
In the theater, it's bad enough in the movies where you've paid $10, but in the theater.
Yeah, it was kind of unreal. But I enjoyed it.
The woman who played the Whoopi Goldberg part, she was terrific.
Amazing, really.
And that's
incredible.
Really hard to play a part that
Oda Mae Brown
is so identified with somebody. Right. But she was, Divine Joy Randolph was her name. She
Divine Joy.
Wow. She was fabulous.
It was a good weekend. It was also Passover and Easter. So we did the vegan Passover at Marissa Miller Wolfson and David Wolfson's house.
That was lovely.
It was really lovely.
We used the Jonathan Safran for Haggadah.
Oh, wow. I really liked his Haggadah.
It was very progressive. Mm-hmm. He edited it. And right. There were various writers that contributed to it. It was very progressive, very thoughtful.
I talked about racism at one point. Like, that was the part that I had to read.
That's kind of what you're supposed to do with Passover, is think about oppression.
Right. Well, but most of the Haggadahs missed the boat on that, so it was refreshing to have one that did. And we also read from the Haggadah for the Liberated Lamb, which is one that we've used in the past, and there was a feminist one, too. Gotta love it. And I actually made enough charoset to feed a small army.
Yes, and fortunately, people loved it.
So they did, but...
a lot, but everybody left with a big bucket of
way too
charoset.
Much. Do you know what I did
Maybe you
with,
should explain do you know what charoset is.
No, people know what charoset is. It's like chopped up apples and walnuts and sweetener, and I made half with alcohol, wine, and half without. And what I did the next day with some of our leftovers is I made oatmeal, and then I microwaved in some charoset. It was so good.
I have to say that I want you to make charoset year-round now.
Oh, but then
our oatmeal. It was so good.
It was delicious. And all of the food was just really lovely. And Chloe was there from Girly Girl Army, and she's kind of a hoot. And just a bunch of other amazing activists and people. So that was actually a really good time. And the next day was Easter.
With my family. Mm-hmm.
They're lovely. We got the most thoughtful present from your niece.
I know.
Well, actually, you got it. You got the present.
She's
it was your
sweetheart.
Birthday. But she got us a travel book about Portland and stuck in there a gift certificate to Portobello.
Which I have never been to.
The restaurant in Portland.
I hear a fabulous vegan restaurant in Portland, which you have been to about a dozen times.
Not a dozen.
And I've never been to.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to go now.
No,
we're
going to
go every
gift?
Night.
You get half of it.
I do.
Unless
you order $100. With the food.
It could
and
happen.
I have to have water.
It could happen.
So we have a lot of speaking engagements coming up. This weekend, which is when you're listening to this, we'll be speaking at the Worcester Veg Fest, which I cannot wait to speak at.
I mean, we're in August company.
No, I know. It's us and T. Colin Campbell and Kathy Freston and Nathan Runkle.
Does anybody come to see us?
No, actually. Yeah. Nobody's going to come see us, but we'll listen to each other.
I'll tell you did a great job.
And if you're listening to this on the day that our podcast goes up, which is Saturday, then you still have one day to plan your trip to the Worcester Veg Fest, because we're speaking Sunday, which is tomorrow, if you're listening to this Saturday, and you still have time to get there.
And carry an Our Hen House flag and act like we're the most important speakers.
Right. Just be like Kathy Freston. Nah. T. Colin Campbell.
Who?
Nah.
Who?
Nathan Runkle and his investigation.
What? Mercy for Animals on
Our Hen House.
Whoa.
So we also have the Connecticut Veg Fest coming up that we're speaking at. The Seed Experience with Erin Red from Red Radio, which is great. Manhattan Community Church. Brooklyn Food Festival, also known as the Occupy Wall Street. And then there's more, too.
I'm going to pass out.
I've already passed. I've actually...
April is a really hard month when you teach. Mm-hmm. Like, everything's, like, coming to a head.
Right. I'm sure, because then you have papers to grade and things like that. Yeah. Wow, you just sprouted a gray hair. That's amazing. Hey, speaking of hair, I got an undercut on the left side of my head.
It looks fabulous.
And I have all these little gray hairs popping out of it. Yeah. And I say bring it, because I'm okay looking, you know, like
my age. Yeah, just wait another 5 years.
But people think I'm so look younger than I am, so I'm like, all right.
Matt, they say that, honey.
That you think they're lying? I look like an NYU student.
Well, it might be the tattoos.
In Portland, I will just fit right in.
Yes, you will. I'm going to have to get a tattoo.
So you are a pigeon.
I'm going to be the only person in the whole city.
That's how they'll describe you. Marianne. Oh, the one without
the tattoo.
Right, that's right. Everything else is just ordinary.
There are very tattooed people out there.
And a very vegan people out there, too. So when this airs, I will have done Mortified again, and hopefully it went well. Mortified is the show that I used to produce and also host and perform in sometimes that I'm now excited to be going back to perform in. that where you read your middle school journals verbatim in front of hundreds of strangers.
And we all have a glimpse into how crazy you truly are.
In fact, it's true. It was my piece is like the how could I not have known I was gay piece that focuses on my absolute utter obsession with Bette Midler.
Which has not faded, I might add.
Not so much, no. Not so much. So I'm excited about that, and it's just a really exciting week.
I always like those older women.
Well, you know, I have to say that
with the fabulous singing voices.
That worked out for me well. That worked out for me. You know, it is true. I was very into my teachers, and of course, I wound up with a professor who's much older than me.
Professor Anne Marianne.
Professor Anne Marianne. I hope people get that. It always concerns me that they don't.
Yeah, partially because it means that you're so old.
One of my favorite parts about last week was that we saw Timothy Patcherat speak. We talked about his book, Every 12 Seconds, last week on our podcast, which really was mind-blowing.
Has blown me away.
So you finished reading it. I've started reading it. And we got to see him speak at CUNY last week. And aside from the fact that there was cheese there.
Well, that wasn't his fault. He was not the host. He doesn't teach there.
No, it wasn't his fault at all.
He teaches at the new school.
But it was an eye-opening and enlightening talk. And I'm just kind of excited for us and for all of our listeners that we're going to get to talk to Timothy.
I am so excited.
Do you just give us the nutshell version?
Powerful voice.
Give the nutshell version of his book for those people who, for some inexplicable reason, missed our episode last week.
Well, as I'm sure that they will get in more detail, he went, I guess you could say, undercover, though I don't think he just didn't tell them his true purpose. In a slaughterhouse in Omaha, I think this was back in 2004, worked there for 6 months and wrote this meticulously detailed account of all the different jobs he had, and some of which dealt with the animals, many of which did not, and his observations of the way in which the people intersect and the animals intersect with them, and the ways in which people hide, even in that situation, people can hide from the violence.
One thing to keep in mind when you're listening to this interview is that following the interview, we're going to give you some very exciting news about how you can get a signed copy of Timothy Patcherat's book, Every 12 Seconds, by supporting our hen house. So make sure you stay on and listen to the rest of the podcast episode for more information on how to get that, because you're going to want it. Well, let's hear right from Timothy exactly what happened and what his evolving thoughts are. I'm just so excited. Timothy Patcherat. Timothy Patcherat received his PhD from Yale University and works as an assistant professor in the Department of Politics at the New School for Social Research. His research and teaching interests include comparative politics, the politics of Southeast Asia, spatial and visual politics, the sociology of domination and resistance, the political economy of dirty and dangerous work, and interpretive and ethnographic research methods. Timothy's work has received awards from the American Political Sciences Association's section on qualitative methods and from the American Political Science Association's Labor Project. He is the author of Every 12 Seconds, Industrialized Slaughter and the Politics of Sight, which was published by Yale University Press in 2011, and is a political ethnography of immigrant labor on the kill floor of an industrialized slaughterhouse that explores how violence that is seen as both essential and repugnant to modern society is organized, disciplined, regulated, and reproduced. Timothy grew up in northeastern and northern Thailand and lives in Brooklyn, New York. We are here today being joined live and in person here in our hen house, our actual hen house, by Timothy Patcherat, the author of Every 12 Seconds, Industrialized Slaughter and the Politics of Sight, a book that I cannot get Marianne to stop talking about. So thanks a lot, Timothy. But for real, we're very big fans of you, and I'm completely starstruck with the fact that you're here in our living room right now.
I am too. Like, I spent like days just immersed in your life, and here you are right in my home. I'm so excited. And I'm really curious as to how this all started and what the process was that led you to work at a slaughterhouse, and what were you hoping to explore and discover in this journey?
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me here. I'm a big fan of our hen house, and I think you guys are a force in the world and will increasingly grow as one in the world, so it's an honor to be here with you and the very lovely Rose who is sitting right behind me. This book project really started when I was a graduate student at Yale University. I was getting my PhD in political science, and I am from Thailand, and wanted to study politics initially because of the anti-military, pro-democracy movements that occurred in Thailand. And that was sort of my entree into thinking about power and politics. And when I started at Yale, I thought I was going to write a dissertation on social movements in Thailand, looking at environmental and labor rights social movements in Thailand. But somewhere in the second year of graduate school, I thought, you know, I have time for that. This is a moment when I can do something that's completely unexpected, where I really put myself at risk in research in some ways that's not so removed. And frankly, was quite tired of critiques of processes that were happening outside of the United States and wanted to take a hard, critical look at how power works in the United States. And at the time, had been doing a lot of diverse reading, including Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation, and Zygmunt Bauman's book, Modernity and the Holocaust, which explores the rationalization and bureaucratization of violence in modern society. And Norbert Elias's wonderful book, The Civilizing Process, which actually plays a huge sort of theoretical role in Every 12 Seconds, where the basic argument is that in civilization, we don't eliminate or transform violent processes. We merely conceal them and push them further out of sight. And so I really wanted to understand how massive processes of violence are normalized in everyday life, and wanted to do so from an ethnographic perspective. And that's what led me to look at an industrialized slaughterhouse from an ethnographic perspective.
So tell us a bit about the conclusions regarding the processes as you were talking about pushing out processes of violence so that we can't see them. But even within the slaughterhouse itself, you found that people were able, even people who worked on the kill floor, to distance themselves from the work of killing. Tell us how that worked.
Yeah, this is really one of the big points that I make in the book and that comes out of the research. I mean, I think we're all fairly aware that slaughterhouses as a whole are segregated from society. Most meat consumers have no idea where this killing takes place, much less what it entails. But what's interesting about the book that I wrote, I think, is that I'm not just exploring the distance between society as a whole and the work of killing. I'm looking at what it means from the perspective of those who take part in it to perform this kind of massive, repetitive killing. And as you mentioned, Marianne, one of the major findings that comes out of that research is that the work of distancing and concealment continues all the way down. So there's sort of three or four major ways that this takes place within the slaughterhouse. At the most general level, the slaughterhouse itself is divided into different departments. There's a front office, there's a fabrication department, there's a kill floor, there's a cooler, and the workers in these different departments don't interact with each other and don't have any visual or experiential contact with what goes on in other departments. So I spend some time in the book talking about the front office in relationship to the kill floor, right? The fact that 20 or 30 people, men mostly, control what goes on inside the slaughterhouse without having any direct experiential contact with it. And I see that as a metaphor for a lot of processes in society. And then there's the fabrication department where the half carcasses that have been chilled in the cooler enter and are sort of broken down into the cuts of meat that people find in grocery stores. And there I kind of look at fabrication in a double sense, right? Both the work of constructing or manufacturing cuts of meat, but also the work of making things up, of lying, right? And so there's this very real sense in which what had once been animal and recognizable as animal in the fabrication department is reconstructed as sort of meat, right? Where there's no reference to the life that used to be there. And then on the kill floor itself, we find, interestingly enough, divisions of space and labor that also partition and compartmentalize the work of killing. And one of the most salient of these divisions is the distinction between the clean side and the dirty side, right? So this is a division that came about on the kill floor because of a logic of food safety. You know, people, the clean side is the area where the cattle's hides have been removed. And the dirty side is the area where the hides are still on the animals. And so fecal material is on the hides. And the distinction is there to prevent the transfer of fecal material to the carcass. But what's interesting is the workers who work on the dirty side and the clean side are segregated not only during the work process, but during the breaks as well. So there's separate bathrooms for dirty side workers, right? Literally labeled dirty men's bathroom, for example. So what this means is that the experience, the broad experience of working with these carcasses when they still have the hides on and therefore look very much more like an animal versus when they have their hides off and are already looking less like an animal, that these phenomenological distinctions are continue even in the break area itself. And then, you know, there's the compartmentalization that happens in the killing itself. So there's of a total workforce of over 800 workers, only 7 workers in the slaughterhouse actually have any contact with the live cattle, and only 4 are directly involved with the actual taking of life. And even that process of killing is spatially divided so that the person who's shooting the animal in the heads is out of the line of sight from the 2 people who are slitting the animal's throat. So the very act of killing becomes dislocated, both spatially, morally, and experientially, where it's not possible to actually say this is the single site or this is the single act where the act where the work of killing takes place. And all of this, I think, is highly significant for thinking about the structure of violence against animals, but also other kinds of violence in our society, where there's a dislocation of moral, experiential responsibility. I just wanted to also mention linguistically, right? The fact that these animals, from the time they're unloaded at the slaughterhouse, are referred to as beef rather than as cattle, right? And when you're working in the chutes, which I did, which is where the live animals are driven into the kill box, this language helps to sort of frame what's happening as a stream of raw material coming through rather than an engagement or a confrontation with each individual animal. So, I mean, there's more I can say about this, but perhaps as the interview goes on.
Or people can also read the book, which you have an extraordinary amount to say about it. And there's actually a story you told right at the beginning of the book about an escaped cow. I think escaped animals have such an enormous place in the consciousness of people in the animal rights movement. They symbolize so much. And this was actually an amazing story within the context of the slaughterhouse. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, this story really frames some of the basic questions of the book. In 2004, pretty early on in my field work, 6 cattle escaped from a slaughterhouse up the street from the one I was working in. And a number of them actually ran straight to St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church. St. Francis is, of course, the patron saint of animals. They were recaptured and transported back. No, not a sanctuary after all. They were transported back to the slaughterhouse. But a 6th animal, a cream-colored cow, ran into an alleyway that ended in a chain-link fence bordering the slaughterhouse that I was working in. And it just so happened that it was during the 10-minute afternoon break of my slaughterhouse. So a lot of the workers were outside getting some fresh air, smoking cigarettes. And they witnessed the Omaha police chasing this cow and cornering it against this chain-link fence. And after they failed, you know, to herd the animal into a trailer, they actually opened fire on the animal with shotguns and killed it. And what's interesting about this is that in the lunchroom the next day, the outrage on the part of the workers, you know, the sort of horror and outrage and disgust at the killing of this animal by the police was palpable. And the workers identified with this animal, right, saying the police treated this cow just like they treat Mexican people in this country. You know, if you're a Mexican in this country, the police will do anything to you. And there's sort of this palpable sense of outrage at the act of killing. And then the lunch period ends. And the workers, including me, we all go back to our places on the line where we proceed to do that one act that contributes to the taking of 2,500 lives every day. And so it's this sort of juxtaposition between our reactions and our responses to killing when it's unmediated, in a sense, when it's immediate, right, which is sort of represented by the Omaha police killing, versus when it's compartmentalized and divided under the auspices of efficiency or food safety, that I find to be one of the central paradoxes that I want to explore in the book. How are things concealed, and what happens when they're made visible?
When we saw you speak last week, the moderator of the panel referred to the slaughterhouse as a metaphor for other forms of violence. We see this often, that violence against animals is not seen as a problem, but as a stand-in for violence against humans. Do you find that your book is often met with this kind of reaction? Because I know that there is legitimacy to what she's saying at the same time, and you even mentioned it yourself, but still it frustrated me that that was the very first thing she mentioned.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's interesting because the response to the book, I think, is actually quite the opposite. That for the most part, people find the kind of meticulous documentation of what happens in the industrialized slaughterhouse so overwhelming that they can't help but avoid with engaging with the question of violence against non-human animals, right? And so in that sense, I often feel that I have to work to move the conversation in the other direction, which is, yes, this case is absolutely about violence, but I also want you to be provoked to think about the continuities, right, between how we treat non-human creatures and how we treat each other, or how we treat even other forms of life, such as the environment. And so to me, I use the word metaphor, but it's more the continuities that I want to stress, right? That we often want to make this sharp division between violence against non-human animals and violence against human animals. And yet I think the basic mechanisms that allow those forms of violence to continue and be reproduced are very similar. And so if we can take a case like the slaughterhouse, which people are so intimately involved in through virtue of eating, and make it come home, I think it raises all kinds of other important questions. And in general, I think this is a good way to think about animal rights and the animal rights movement more broadly, which is to stress the continuities between forms of oppression and domination rather than the uniqueness. And I think this is where the animal rights movement could actually be more effective.
Yeah, talking about the commonality of the mindset of the oppressor is something that we've talked quite a lot about here. And I agree with you. I mean, I know that some of the listeners of our podcast have really come to animal rights by way of a different form of social justice work. I came to animal rights by way of AIDS awareness, activism, things like that. So I appreciate that your book goes there. But I also think it's so important that people look at this for what it is literally too, and not ignore that. I like how you're saying it from a continuity perspective. Another question that came up from several people in the audience was the question of slaughter in traditional societies, and particularly ritualized slaughter. What do you say to those who contend that our perception of slaughter as an issue of violence is cultural?
I think that, you know, one of the arguments of the book is actually that I want to historicize how we think about violence and our responses to it. I think one of the problems with some forms of political tactics that just try to make certain forms of violence visible and assume a response to them is that they naturalize violence and people's responses to it, in the sense that, oh, there's this kind of timeless ahistorical notion of what violence is, and then there's a timeless ahistorical response that all decent human beings should have to that violence. And I actually think that it's much more historical than that. You know, I actually think that there's an interesting relationship between the visibility or commonality of violence and people's reaction to it through emotions of pity or horror. So there's a sense in which the more things become concealed and distanced from view, the more likely it is that people react with pity or horror to them being made visible. This is kind of a roundabout answer to your question. I mean, I do think that rather than naturalizing violence and pity, it's more useful to think of it as a historical relationship.
Coming back to the exact instance of the kind of comparison they, or example they were using of ritualized slaughter, Do you think that ritual is one more way of achieving distance from the reality of violence, and even while it remains in plain sight? Is that something that resonates for you?
Yeah, you know, I can only speculate on this because I obviously didn't study ritualized forms of slaughter. But I do think that all acts of killing contain within them ways to mediate what's happening, right? Ways to sort of put it in a larger context to make it less of a confrontation with the actual act of killing. And this is just as true for industrialized slaughter, right? And the references to the animals as beef, as it is, I think, in other forms of slaughter that are more traditional or ritualized.
Referring to what you were just saying about whether our reaction to violence is historical or ahistorical or inherent, I guess, and talking about what happens when people are exposed to violent images and what's happening with that today, whether just exposing what's going on is going to change people's hearts and minds and make them horrified, or whether it's actually going to somehow familiarize themselves with this horror, if I understand some of the points that you're making. So the images created by people, groups like Mercy for Animals, which are really changing the way people perceive what's going on with animals and bringing the truth to people, I guess may not be enough to change everybody's hearts and minds. And we've certainly seen that. I mean, people have seen these images and processed them in some way. And that may even create a hazard of people becoming kind of used to it. Do you think there are ways to contextualize this kind of imagery in a way that will allow people to get this information without, I don't know what the word you would use. The word maybe I would use would be hardening them to the presence of violence.
Yeah, these are great questions, and they're sort of where I end the book, right? With these questions.
I want you to now write another chapter for us here.
Right. Well, that would sort of be the next step in the book. But one thing I do want to problematize with the idea that distancing and concealment happens all the way down in the slaughterhouse, even at the site where we might expect it to be least hidden, right? I mean, it's called the kill floor. It's not even euphemistic in its name. Even there, we find that the direct participants find ways to compartmentalize themselves or compartmentalize through the division of labor and space from the killing. So I think that a politics of sight, which is really what I call what you're referring to, that groups of like Mercy for Animals engage in, trying to make visible what's hidden, is a necessary condition for social change, but it's not a sufficient condition, right? And I think that one of the potential problems with work like that is that it focuses on the most egregious or shocking examples of what's happening, and one sort of difference that I try to portray in the book, which does contain, you know, horrifying incidents, is it's the normalcy. It's the sort of everydayness. It's when it's working at its best that we should find it most horrifying. It's not when the knocking gun doesn't quite work and an animal is, you know, slaughtered while still sentient. Yes, that's absolutely horrifying. That's absolutely shocking. And people should respond to that. But by holding that forth as the image that you want people to respond to, or the information that you want people to respond to, there's a sense in which it normalizes the background against which it's juxtaposed. And so what this book really tries to do through its day in and day out description is show just how horrifying the normalcy of what's happening is, right? It's when plants are being run in accordance with so-called humane handling standards, right? That we find what's most troubling, which is the transformation of individual sentient creatures into raw material for human purposes. I think that there's no single answer to what kinds of additional context are needed to a politics of sight, but I think this is where sort of creative education comes into play, right? I think, just speaking personally here, having the chance to engage and interact with individual creatures at places like farm sanctuaries can be incredibly powerful when combined with this kind of background information, because it makes concrete or makes visible in a very intimate way what had previously just been abstract knowledge. So it's not just that slaughterhouses engage in this kind of horrific slaughter, it's that they engage in these kinds of horrific slaughter, and this creature standing right in front of me now, who's so obviously delighted to be alive in the world and to be under this sky and standing on this grass, would have been one of those creatures. That kind of combination can be very powerful. But I do think there's no there's no single formula. What's most troubling and what I want to problematize is the sense that a simple politics of sight, a simple revelation of things, will lead to a certain outcome. I mean, just, you know, to sort of be provocative a little bit here, think about movements that engage in a politics of sight that you might absolutely disagree with, right? And you can see how what they're doing as a politics of sight is completely ineffective in terms of changing your mind about anything, right? So, you know, not to make any assumptions about people's politics, but let's take, you know, a group that people wouldn't necessarily lump in with progressive movements. Let's take the pro-life sort of movement, right? So people who stand in front of Planned Parenthood on weekends holding up, you know, big life-size posters of fetuses are engaging from their perspective in what they think of as a politics of sight. They're trying to make visible something that they think is hidden on the assumption that if people just saw it, they would change their attitudes and act politically to end what they consider to be a horrific practice. And there's a parallel there, right? Even though it's hard to consider, there's a parallel there to the tactics that are used in some cases by the animal rights movement. If we could just make this visible, people would of course respond to this. But there's a prior frame going on that has to be changed before that kind of visibility can be effective. And it's that frame that I think requires a combination and flexibility of tactics. And that's what I want to call attention to in the book.
I think that's, you know, that's kind of like everything that we try to do here at our hen house is everybody has a different way of educating. And I think when so many of us get involved in this, we do it because we saw some horrific imagery, but that just doesn't have the same effect on everybody. That's what we've all come to realize. So it is so important. And I think the sanctuaries, you're right, is such an important thing. And I think the arts are as well. Sometimes when things are fiction, it's easier for people to hear them than when they're real. And I do think the animal rights, I just want to say, I think a lot of the undercover investigations are moving in that way that you're talking about, that they are recording kind of the everyday rather than just the particularly egregious horrific, because the everyday is horrifying enough. You know, I just want to, before we conclude, talk about another issue, because aside from the violence toward the animals, your book reveals many details about how hard so many people work in our society for incredibly small amounts of money, and also how racially stratified such workplaces are. Can you talk a bit about your coworkers and their lives and their attitude towards their work?
Sure. I mean, most of the workers in the plant are documented and undocumented immigrants from Central and South America and from Southeast Asia and from East Asia. The only sort of native-born Americans, I should say, who are in the plant were people who were on prison release time. So it sort of tells you about the stratification that we have in our society where we assign the most morally and physically dirty work to people who have the least amount of rights and privileges in society. And I think this is another place, actually, I'm focusing on sort of the question of the animal rights movement because of the audience here, but I do think this is another place where the animal rights movement could really take a big step forward. I think often when we focus on violence against animals, for example, in slaughterhouses, there's not a real consideration of the human workers in those places. Or if there is, it's sort of, these are the people who are perpetuating the violence, right? But what about the commonalities in the treatment of the workers who often have very, very little choices when it comes to their economic choices of where to work and the treatment of the animals? What about that connection that the workers themselves made between the treatment of the cow that was shot by the Omaha police and their treatment as immigrant workers in the country? What would it mean for the animal rights movement to take up this question seriously as an ally and in solidarity with the human workers in these places, rather than seeing them as simply as perpetrators or as, you know, sadistic sort of outliers? I think this is sort of another area that is open for alliances that might not have been thought about before. So I'm really happy that you asked this question. I mean, most of the workers in the plant are trying to get by, you know, and they live incredibly difficult lives, and they are trading in the utility of their bodies for pay. You know, this work breaks you down. It breaks you down physically. It breaks you down psychologically and emotionally. There's a sense in which the slaughterhouse consumes, right, not only the non-human animals, but also the human workers in the plant.
I want to find out how the experience of doing this changed you, in particular your attitude toward animals and food, but in other ways as well. I'm sensing it from what you've said thus far. But first, I have a question. Who do you think is more responsible, those who work in the slaughterhouse or those who eat the meat?
This is a question that I actually pose at the end of chapter 6 in the book, which is the chapter where I work in the chutes, very close to the knocking box, the person who kills the animals. If I had to answer that question specifically, I think that those who benefit at a distance from the dirty work that others do are actually more responsible, particularly when the people who are directly participating in that work have very few choices in society. But there's another sense in which I think the question itself is kind of a deflection, right? Because we can always assign moral responsibility, but it's much harder to communicate the experience of doing a certain kind of work. So I can totally imagine a meat eater saying, yeah, I'll take moral responsibility for it, while still completely distancing themselves from the realities of what that responsibility requires. And one of the big questions of the book is actually, how would our deliberations and thinking about meat eating and about other forms of violence in society change if these forms of experiential distancing were collapsed? Right. If it wasn't just a question of who's morally responsible, but it was a question of what would it mean for you to directly see, hear, feel, smell, and touch what it means to be involved in this work.
So how has it changed you?
You know, the answer to this question illustrates what I'm talking about in terms of it's not just simple exposure to something that creates transformation. You know, for me, you know, this is very personal, actually. Yeah.
You gonna cry?
No, I'm not gonna cry. You know, this comes back in some ways to your question about metaphors, because for me, when I started this project, it very much was a case that would help me to understand the larger theoretical questions I was interested in about the normalization of violence. And so I took the fact that violence was being committed against animals very seriously, but it was also a way to explore other forms of violence in society. Like, I think, a lot of ethnographic work, the case itself soon began to exercise a specific power over me, where the original interest in the theoretical questions began to recede, and what came to the surface was the actual specificity of what was happening, right? The sort of massive slaughter of these beautiful sentient creatures for food. I had a very ambiguous relationship with meat eating before, during, and after the slaughterhouse work. And it actually wasn't until I visited a farm sanctuary. This was in Woodstock, the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary, actually, that I made the connection in a way that was, for me personally, transformative, and it's why I'm sitting here talking to you now, between what I had experienced and seen in the slaughterhouse and sort of the choices that I was making in terms of how I ate specifically. My 9-year-old daughter, Mia, was with me on that trip. And, you know, before we had even gone in the car to go home, she just kind of declared outright, like, I will never eat animals again. She was actually already vegetarian, but she like said, I'm going to be completely vegan at this point. And so when you have like a 9-year-old like in your life who's taking that kind of stance, it leaves you very little room to like take any stance but a supportive one, given sort of, you know, the conclusions that I was already arriving at. So this is where I think, you know, this question of the politics of sight is very powerful, sort of personally for me, because it was a combination of there was a specific animal there, actually, Kaylee, who had actually escaped from a Pennsylvania slaughterhouse and is now at the farm sanctuary. And so there's this moment, I mean, this sounds very, you know, strange, but there was this moment where I walked up to Kaylee and I just realized, like, look, you know, this is actually, you know, she's a heifer, and this is like one of the animals that would have been, you know, completely immaterial, sort of in the larger scale of what was happening in the slaughterhouse. And it's one of the reasons that even when I first published this book, I was very reluctant to talk about, you know, my politics of meat more generally. I mean, at that point I was already a vegan, but I didn't want the meat issue to, in a way, distract people from the larger questions. And in the last couple of months, there's already been a transformation on my part in how vocal I'm becoming and how willing I'm becoming to sort of make that connection, right? And to say, yes, this is a case of other things, but this case in and of itself is absolutely important. And there's absolutely no justification for the killing and consumption of animals merely for pleasure on our part, which is what it comes down to. So that's kind of my story to date. I'm sure it's going to continue to evolve. But it's one of the reasons why I'm very happy and proud to be here talking to you today, because of the efforts that you do on this front.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And all I have to say is go, Mia. Go, Mia. That's a beautiful story. It really is. And I think it really does demonstrate, you know, what you've said so many times, that you had more information perhaps than anybody, but you could see that you need certain different kinds of information to put them in the right context to make you see it clearly. So thank you so much for sharing that with us and for sharing all of your insights today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Timothy, for joining us. Actually, here in our hen house, we're going to have to schedule an interview with Mia next. Thank you so much again, and thank you. The book is called Every 12 Seconds, Industrialized Slaughter and the Politics of Sight. You want to get this book. Timothy Patrat, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Timothy Patrat, author of Every 12 Seconds. We have some very, very exciting news for those of you who might be interested in reading Timothy's book, and I hope that means you. For a limited time, if you become a monthly donor to Our Hen House of $10 or more per month, again, that's if you become a monthly donor to Our Hen House, donating a minimum of $10 per month, which you could do at ourhenhouse.org/donate, then you will receive a signed copy of Timothy Patrat's book, Every 12 Seconds. And we just can't be more excited about this. So please consider supporting our work by becoming a monthly donor at the $10 or more level. And we will send you a copy of Timothy Patrat's book, Every 12 Seconds. And again, you could find that at ourhenhouse.org/donate. And I hope that you check it out, because I know you want to read it. And now let's get right into some news, shall we? Harvard School of Public Health reports the use of common pesticide is linked to bee colony collapse.
Yeah, they seem to be pretty confident that they have actually tracked down the reason for bee colony collapse, which is this huge problem that honeybees are collapsing and they are absolutely necessary to an enormous amount of agriculture, not to mention just the beautiful world that we live in. Honeybees are a crucial part because they pollinate. And everybody's been wondering what's been causing it, and the Harvard School of Public Health seems to be confident that they have tracked it down to a certain pesticide called imidacloprid. And the bees can get this from the blossoms that they cross-pollinate, but the crucial thing is that they can also get it from the crappy high fructose corn syrup that they're fed when people steal their honey from them. This pesticide is found in corn syrup, which I guess should make people hesitate about eating it too. And when even incredibly small amounts are very harmful to the bees. So that seems to be the reason, and this may have to change the way that beekeeping will be done.
The University of California settles suit with activist group over 2008 raid.
Yeah, you can't hardly help but be happy about this one. The FBI and the University of California conducted this raid of a left-wing Berkeley group on the allegations that they were associated with alleged threats by animal rights advocates, and they it's called Long Haul Inc., and they run a newspaper out of their store as well as their bookstore, and they have public computer terminals, and apparently on what was probably false information, a warrant was obtained, and the police or the FBI and federal agents and other officers and the University of California police went in there, tore the place apart, and behaved very badly, and broke locks when people were offering to open things. And turns out that, you know, they really didn't have the goods and they really couldn't support the warrant. And you're really, really not supposed to go into newspaper offices unless you have a really good reason. So Long Haul sued the FBI and the University of California. They've just settled for $100,000. The university still contends that it didn't do anything wrong, which begs the question of why they're willing to fork over $100,000.
Yeah, and from One Green Planet and from Minneapolis, Slaughter-Free City, Progress for Chickens in Minneapolis, and this is by Ian Elwood.
Yes, Ian actually informed us of this wonderful progress in Minneapolis, and they have added regulations to their code that governs how chickens can be kept in Minneapolis, and they have prohibited slaughter, which is huge, and they've also just really reformed the way that the chickens can be kept. They have to be kept as pets on residential property and not in, you know, these semi-commercial urban farms, which people like to think of are chicken-friendly but are actually horrible. So it will be very, very difficult for anybody to be keeping chickens for any kind of commercial use in Minneapolis, which is great news.
And from ABC News, Pennsylvania egg factory accused of animal cruelty and filth.
Yeah, save the big story for the last. Probably people have already heard it by now, but HSUS broke its latest undercover video. The story was broken by Nicholas Kristof in his column in the New York Times, and they focused on Creeder Farms in Pennsylvania, and clearly the reason that they were focusing on Creeder Farms is because they are not members of the UEP and they're not supporting the legislation that HSUS is supporting in Congress. So they're trying to show how problematic facilities are, not only that are part of the UAP, but the ones opposing it are opposing it because they're totally horrible and not because this legislation isn't necessary. Creeder Farms seems to be taking the position that this didn't happen, that this video was not shot in their facilities. You know, I'm sure that they have the goods on them and really horrible things. This stuff we're very familiar in seeing in egg undercover investigations. Obviously, nothing is changing at all. They're all as bad as they ever were, and they found injured and dead hens, mummified bird carcasses living in the same cages as live hens, and a lot of chickens who were caught in the cages, either by their heads or legs or wings. Just dreadful stuff. It just goes on and on and on. This is going on all the time in our country, and every once in a while it surfaces through one of these terrific undercover investigations. So that's great news, and I hope it will get more and more press.
And that was our news. So we did a review of our favorite kitchen appliances twice because we have a lot of kitchen appliances.
I think we have actually several more reviews.
We have a few reviews that we could pull out of that. And we weren't sure how people would like it, but we got quite a few comments from people saying that they liked it. So we thought, what else can we review that's just in our lives that we like? And since you seem to find it interesting, we thought that we would go in that direction. Of course, it's a slight diversion from our normal reviewing an animal rights film kind of thing. But today we're going to talk about three easy ways that we use frozen fruits and vegetables.
I know it sounds ridiculous.
It does.
I really find that there are a lot of people who don't appreciate the wonders of frozen fruits and vegetables, who think that you should only buy fresh. And which I'm all for fresh vegetables.
We have them in our house.
I love my frozen stuff. I do. Well, I am not one who likes to spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
Really?
Yes. But I like to eat really healthy food. And frozen fruits and vegetables are, to me, just a miracle. Like, they never go bad,
yeah,
for one thing.
I think
I am always letting fresh vegetables go.
No, you're not, because I don't let you, because
well,
we have it.
I
but
have
you
in the
almost
past.
Do. It's, yeah, maybe in the past, and we will sometimes grab that piece of lettuce 5 seconds before it's about to wilt.
Yeah.
And we always have fresh fruit and vegetables in our house,
it's
too.
It's so easy for us to get them, too. We can get them down the corner, but
right.
Still, I just love to have a freezer
something about
full
it.
Of frozen fruits and vegetables. They're just always there. You can add loads and loads of them to whatever you're making, and you don't have to worry about running out to the store
or washing them. Even
you don't have to wash them, you don't have to prep them, they're all cut. You know, prepping vegetables takes a long time, just when you really don't want to mess around a lot but you want to eat really healthy. I just can't. And the really amazing thing about them is that they're just as good for you as fresh, in some cases even better, because they're frozen right after they're picked, by and large, and so the nutrients are really preserved. Mm-hmm. So all in all, I just love them. And I particularly think that they're very good for the shortcut.
Yeah.
The shortcut while not going unhealthy, which is just the hardest thing in the world, because it's the time that you tend to, like, jump off the deep end and eat something that you then regret eating and that isn't very good for you. But if you really want to make something quick, a lot of times the thing that's quick is you know, mm-hmm. not that healthy, but not when you've got frozen fruits and vegetables.
So let's talk about our three favorite ways to use them. Now, we weren't sure if we were going to make this one list or two, but it turns out we both completely agree on our three favorite ways to use frozen fruits and vegetables. So let's talk about number one, which is just so lovely and wonderful that I think your life might be about to change. And it involves frozen cherries. Frozen cherries are our absolute favorite fruit.
I know. I pretty much want cherries like all for dessert time. Every night.
There you have it. We have a favorite dessert and it involves frozen cherries. And there's two ways of doing this. One is take a bag of frozen cherries, put it in a bowl and microwave it for like many minutes. Then you have hot frozen cherries and they kind of sit in their own juice and you could just have them with a spoon. It's quite lovely.
Don't eat the spoon.
And there's also taking the cherries while they're frozen and pouring some kind of a milk on it, like hemp milk. The chocolate hemp milk is lovely.
I love that chocolate hemp milk.
Tempt, right.
Yeah. But any kind of chocolate
We don't even always use that because I'm not.
No.
There's an almond milk. I think it's Almond Breeze that's unsweetened. That's also really good on the frozen cherries. And sometimes it hardens around the frozen cherry a little bit. It's just delicious.
But the other way is if you have a Vitamix, to stick them in the Vitamix and then you get sorbet. You could make that with any kind of fruit. But of course, cherries are. Remember, like
ran out.
Yeah, for a while, nobody had frozen cherries. We were like almost had to be hospitalized.
You should have seen our cart at Whole Foods
when we found them the day they got cherries back.
I think we got all of the bags of frozen cherries that they had there. It was embarrassing, but oh so gratifying at the same time. Our second favorite way to use frozen fruits and veggies are, of course, smoothies.
You kind of do have to have a Vitamix for this or a really powerful blender because the frozen stuff, if you're going to blend it, is kind of hard. And so you have to have something that really can stand up to it. But if you make a smoothie and you put frozen fruit in it,
frozen greens,
and then you can load it up with frozen greens and you can really sneak an enormous amount of greens in there without it ruining the flavor. I mean, it just becomes more delicious. Sometimes, I mean, I know you're thinking it's going to taste like a kale smoothie, but it doesn't. It tastes like a fruit smoothie. It does get a little green.
Yeah, well, I like the color of it
But you can put so many greens in there.
And you could even mix it with water. You don't have to mix it with
milk. No, you don't have to use milk.
So
Fruit and
sometimes
greens.
We'll even add peas, like frozen peas.
Yeah, or pumpkin. I tried pumpkin the other day. Because it gives it a real thickness.
Frozen pumpkin, which I haven't found at many places. I found it at like a Korean grocery store, so I picked it up. And it was very nice in the smoothie. So just make sure that you're always stocked, your cabinet is always stocked. And if you have a high-powered blender or a Vitamix, once you initially blend what you're making, throw more greens in.
Just keep throwing them and tasting until you hit the limit.
Now talk about
if you put a little mint in there.
Or ginger. I like putting fresh ginger in it, but another option is to put some ginger, like dried ginger powder, which I did the other day because I didn't have fresh, and it adds a nice little spiciness,
And when it's frozen, it just gets thicker and it's icy cold. So I want one right now.
I do too, kind of. But your third favorite way.
This is my favorite.
This is yours. I like it very much, especially because it involves you making dinner and not me.
Well, it's the easiest meal in the world. And you just take a can of soup. Hopefully a reasonably healthy soup, but it doesn't have to be
that healthy. Dr. Furman has a good soup.
Yeah, Dr. Furman is a good one, but it can be any soup.
Low sodium.
But, you know, soup itself, it's just soup. If you take frozen vegetables, especially like some peas and greens and just really pour a lot in and let it cook down. You have like this unbelievably healthy vegetable stew that took you 2.5 seconds to make. And as an added taste treat, you can stir in a little tahini or cashew butter at the end to make it thick and creamy. And it seriously takes no time. It's really, really good. And because, you know, if you buy a canned soup, it has some flavor in it and some spices and stuff. So you just don't have to think about anything, which is my goal in cooking.
I know. And that is absolutely our big secrets about ways to use frozen fruits and vegetables. If you have other ways that you like to use them, let us know. You could find us on Facebook at facebook.com/ourhenhouse. You could find us on Twitter at ourhenhouse. You could email us info@ourhenhouse.org. You could comment on the blog that accompanies this podcast episode, which you could find also at ourhenhouse.org. And if you like what you're listening to, please consider leaving a friendly review on iTunes, because we do rely on those reviews. We also rely on your support financially, because we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We are reader and listener supported. So if you like what you're listening to, and if you check out our daily blogs, then please consider giving any level of support that you possibly can. If that means $100, awesome. If that means $5, awesome. Whatever you can swing. And if you'd like, through the end of the month, you could make it part of our fundraising campaign to help us get this online magazine. The website for that is crowdrise.com/OHH magazine. Again, it's crowdrise.com/OHH magazine. But if you'd like to get in on some of our thank you gifts, donate through our website instead, ourhenhouse.org/donate, or just ourhenhouse.org. You'll see a big donate button. And our thank you gifts are fantastic, I must say. For a $25 donation, we'll send you a copy of The Tourist Trail by John Yonker. This is a book you want to read. It's a novel. It has incredible, incredible messaging throughout it. Very animal friendly, but it's also got a ton of love story and romance and mystery and drama. And I think we read it in like 3 days. We have a review on our website too, so you should check that out. For a $50 donation, we'll send you an Our Hen House tote bag. It's ethically sourced and vegan made out of soda bottles and water bottles, and it's made with soy-based ink, and it's made by the fabulous folks at Lion's Share Industries, so it's all vegan designed. It's more ethical than most people, so check that out. And for a $75 donation, we'll send you a vegan necklace. It's silver and hematite, and it says vegan on it in a beautiful little plate, so check that out. You could see all this at ourhenhouse.org on the top if you go to stuff. And as I mentioned earlier, we now have a fantastic thank you gift from Timothy Petret himself. He is donating you a copy of his book, Every 12 Seconds, and it's signed and it's fabulous. And you will get that if you become a monthly supporter of Our Hen House at the $10 or more a month level. So please consider becoming a monthly supporter, especially if you listen to our podcast. It really helps us to continue doing what we're doing, and now you'll get a signed copy of Timothy's book too. So go to ourhenhouse.org/donate. If you want to read more about all this, you can on the stuff page. Speaking of stuff, we have an Etsy page too. Everything is donated, and it's at etsy.com/shop/ourhenhouse. So you could shop around there. Mother's Day is coming up. That's a really great gift for mom or for yourself. Maybe you're a mom to a dog or a cat. Maybe you're not a mom at all. Why not have your own Mother's Day? I want my Mother's Day. Why not use Mother's Day to celebrate Mother Earth? There you go. So feel free to shout out at us, info@ourhenhouse.org. And thank you so much for joining us today once again.